This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. If you're in the business, you call this drive time radio. But there's a good chance that as you listen right now, you're going nowhere fast. Greater Boston traffic is ranked as among the worst in the country, and it costs you time and money. The average driver in this area today spends twice as much time in traffic as 30 years ago. We're telling you this because this morning, WBUR introduces what we call Bostonomics, a new effort to understand our economy and the people who are changing it. To begin the effort, we're looking this week at Boston traffic and what might be done about it. To figure out where we're going, WBUR's Bruce Gellerman first takes a look in the rearview mirror, looking back in part one of our series, Driving Us Crazy.
Let's start where things began to stall nearly 400 years ago, at the scene of the city's first traffic choke point. Boston historian Jim Vrabel stands near East Berkeley and Washington Street, a site once called Boston Neck.
It was the narrow strip of land that connected the Shawmut Peninsula to the mainland, and it was the only way in or out of colonial Boston.
This might be like the original bottleneck.
It was a bottleneck, and it was a bottleneck intentionally. It was chosen by the early European settlers for defensive purposes.
And to punish offenses, past gate and guardhouse, the road led out of Boston, and for some, to perdition, where crowds of rubbernecking Puritans blocked traffic to watch Quakers, witches, and thieves hang at Boston's gallows.
Thousands of people attended. Another man executed for robbery was described as being launched into eternity here. So it was a pretty somber place.
What's interesting, I'm just looking at the traffic, it's pretty quiet here now.
It's pretty quiet here now because there are a lot more ways to get in and out of Boston than there used to be. Back in the old days, this was the only place.
The single road at Boston Neck led to a network of footpaths worn into the wilderness over thousands of years.
This map shows just a little bit of a path going from Boston all the way up to Springfield. And that was basically what the Native Americans used.
Brian Farm is an amateur highway historian. The self-taught Rhodes Scholar says colonists found the native Pequot and Bay footpaths slow-going.
The first trip was in the late 1600s, and it took 2 weeks to get from Boston to New York City.
British King George II was first to decide roads were needed to rule the colonies. His government-funded road project widened 1,300 miles of footpaths for wagons and stagecoaches. In 1751, Boston-born Deputy Postmaster Ben Franklin used a homemade odometer to measure distances along the King's Highway to determine rates for sending mail.
He went through and measured with a bunch of surveyors every mile from New York City to Boston along this new post road.
You can still see some of Franklin's milestones set along the upper Boston Post Road. Much of it would become Route 20.
All begins right here. This was the main route to get out of Boston.
Brian Farr, founder of the historic Route 20 Association, says the road, which starts in Kenmore Square, is the nation's oldest and longest highway, stretching 3,365 miles west to Newport, Oregon, a scenic free ride across the country. But colonial capitalists thought there was money to be made in roadways. Route 9 began as the Worcester Turnpike in 1810. One of the many private roads built during the golden age of turnpikes. But it was a financial failure. The four toll booths were easily shunned, and travelers soon preferred the newly built Boston to Worcester Railroad.
To work upon the railway.
The new steam engine railroad technology and a wave of new immigrants transformed the nation's transportation landscape.
In 1843, I sailed away across the sea. I sailed away across the sea to work upon the railway.
By the mid-1800s, Massachusetts had the most extensive network of railroads in the country, Boston at the center. The word commuter was coined to describe passengers on the Dedham to Boston line who carried no luggage and therefore paid commuted fares. Boston got its first electric streetcar in 1888, and within 2 years, the hub of the universe was jammed with traffic. By one count, in a single hour, 332 electric streetcars traveled along Tremont Street.
The percentage perception of traffic in the 1890s was that traffic was terrible.
Asha Weinstein Agrawal is a professor of urban and regional planning at San Jose State University. She wrote her dissertation comparing the public's perception of Boston's traffic in the 1890s and 1920s. Streetcars left a lot to be desired. They were loud, dangerous, and slow. One commentator joked they should have sleeping and dining cars.
Yes, you would hear people saying that you could walk faster than you could travel in certain parts of the city on the streetcars.
The public demanded lawmakers address traffic congestion.
The focus was really more on some kind of big construction project, basically to create physical space for traffic.
Boston built space underground. The nation's first subway opened in 1897. 2 years later, South Station opened. It was the largest and soon the busiest train station in the world. North Station was second. At the peak, on board, nearly 70 million passengers a year. But Boston's streets were rapidly being clogged with another kind of traffic, newfangled horseless carriages. Stanley steamers made in Watertown, Duryea motor wagons, and Rolls-Royces from Springfield and Fords mass-produced in Cambridge clogged streets. There were no rules of the road, and streets were a mess. A study in 1892 found 90% were in poor condition. Ryan Price, an editor with Chilton Automotive, says lawmakers again had to address the problem.
And since they decided traffic is going to get worse because there's just automobiles not going away and they're getting more and more and more of them, that they need to come up with a solution.
In 1903, Massachusetts lawmakers created the Automobile Department. But it took one man's frustration and creative genius to come up with a new way to curb cars. No, not Ludwig von Beethoven, but Henry Lee Higginson, founder of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Higginson was sick and tired of drivers racing by his home at a blazing 15 miles an hour.
He wanted to have knowledge of who was driving what cars so they could be brought to justice for speeding. So he kind of used his influence to address the problem.
Higginson submitted a petition to register automobiles, and Massachusetts became the first state in the nation to issue license plates. The fee, $2 a year. That first year, there were 3,200 cars registered in the Commonwealth. By 1926, 140,000 vehicles were driving in and out of Boston a day. To reduce congestion, the city issued its first parking ticket.
Boston Common, in the heart of Boston, one of the oldest of America's great cities.
Boston's planning board declared automobile traffic was, quote, strangling the city. Once again, the solution was construction. Road building boomed. Work on the Central Artery began in the 1950s and was documented in this National Geographic special. The homes of thousands of Boston residents were demolished to make room for the road.
The main feature of this so-called progress is an elevated six-lane expressway that rips its way through the heart of Boston.
A structure like that was considered to be a sexy thing. Cars are up in the sky, people are down on the ground.
The 1950s and 60s ushered in an era of space-age optimism and technology. America's technology highway, Route 128, was constructed around Boston, and the Mass Pike was built to speed suburbanites into the city by day and out by night. The post-war exodus to the burbs left Boston's population and economy in freefall. State officials came up with a traffic master plan, and again, the solution was more roads. But this time, it was to reverse the flow of vehicles and fortunes.
It was actually devised to bring traffic into Boston.
Boston historian Jim Vrabel.
Boston was dying at the time, and they thought if they brought more traffic in, they'd bring more business in. Plus, the federal government was going to support it, pay 90% of the cost.
The proposed road, dubbed the Inner Beltway, called for erecting an eight-lane highway, five stories above street level, looping through Somerville, Cambridge, and Boston, connecting to the Southeast Expressway. At one point, the raised roadway would have sliced between the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and the Museum of Fine Arts.
Eventually, people howled at that, and they were going to build it underground, but they were going to build it above ground through Roxbury and the South End and through all the other neighborhoods.
Outraged activists took to the streets, and the Inner Beltway became the road not taken. Instead, in 1971, the federal highway funds went to improve Boston's subway system. Mass transit ridership soared, but the central artery, driven through the heart of the city, was soon choking with traffic, carrying three times more vehicles than it was designed for. Again, the statehouse solution to congestion? Construction. But President Reagan repeatedly vetoed federal funding for the so-called Big Dig.
The bill's a textbook example of special interest pork barrel politics at work, and I have no choice but to veto it.
Reagan vetoing this thing was outrageous.
Then Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation Fred Salvucci persevered. Congress overrode the funding veto by a single vote. Building the Big Dig took 15 years and was completed a decade ago. Final cost, $24 billion. Nearly $500,000 an inch. The massive project opened up the cityscape, reduced auto emissions into the air, and traffic congestion. But quickly, the added capacity attracted more drivers, pushing bottlenecks further into the suburbs.
Big Dig, man, I don't know.
Boston driver Kerwin Graham offers a familiar lament.
I think the Big Dig is a big disappointment. You know, there's more traffic than ever to be. Yeah.
Additional capacity is part of the solution, but we can't just build our way out of congestion.
Urban traffic expert Bill Isley says when it comes to roads, if you build it, they will come. Today, you have to leave three times earlier than usual if you want to get someplace in the Boston area during rush hour. But if you think your traffic is bad, consider Don Burgess. As head of Boston's Traffic Management Center, he's been stuck in traffic for over four decades, trying to figure out ways to get things moving faster. Burgess looks back to the future for a solution.
You know, it's funny, you look back at some old traffic engineering manuals from the 40s and 50s, and, you know, the driver behavior and the space between cars and the acceleration, it hasn't changed that much.
So if we're not going to change our driving behavior and can't build our way out of congestion, then in the future, we'll need smarter roads and cars so traffic isn't driving us crazy.
So much traffic cuts the flow down.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Bruce Kellerman.
To date, you can bet your high compression, we're gonna be late.
For historic photos of Boston and its legacy of traffic, go to our website, WBUR.org.
Yuck, yuck.
While we're waiting around, singing the blues, turn on the radio for highway news.
Route 302.
Yeah.
It's hard to get through.
Oh.
405.
Yeah.
You'll never arrive.
No.
Route 509. You can't go wrong. They're bumper to bumper, but they're moving along.